Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
On the broadcast today, three stories on the theme of big data. Who decides what ads you see and when you see them? When the NSA goes looking for you, how easy is it to hide? And what happens when government uses data to save money? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 29th of July. Good as always to have you with us. President Obama's going back out on the road tomorrow, day three of his economic swing through the American heartland. Chattanooga, Tennessee is where he's going to be precise. He'll be speaking at a big Amazon warehouse about jobs and the recovering economy. That's quite handy, as it turns out, because just today, Amazon said it's going to hire 5,000 people full-time to staff its ever-expanding distribution network. The company says these are not going to be, quote, your typical warehouse jobs. So we sent Shannon Mullen off this morning to find out why that is.
These days, Amazon.com sells pretty much everything, so its warehouses have to be pretty big. Amazon spokeswoman Kelly Cheeseman.
The majority of our fulfillment centers are about 1 million square feet, so the equivalent to 27 football fields.
Full-time workers have to be able to run a forklift, move heavy stuff, and do a lot of walking, bending, and reaching, up to 12 hours a day. They get health care, a 401k, and some company stock. And Amazon says the median pay is about 30% higher than traditional retail jobs. The Department of Labor says the median wage in retail is about $10 an hour, so the Amazon jobs would pay about $13. And Cheeseman says the company will cover up to $3,000 of college tuition a year.
For courses related to in-demand fields, regardless of whether the skills are relevant to a career at Amazon.
This burst of new jobs from an online retailer is a good sign for the industry, says Heather Boucher, a chief economist at the Center for American Progress.
So if these jobs are being paid a little bit better or a lot better than the old school retail jobs, then that certainly says something about the kind of economy that we could be creating moving forward.
As the current economy recovers, 5,000 new jobs is a lot from one retailer, says Diana Furchgott-Roth, a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
It's a very positive sign for Amazon. Whether it's a positive sign for other retailers, I'm not quite sure, because it's so convenient for many people to order from Amazon.com rather than going to their shopping malls or your local corner store.
That competition could ultimately cost jobs at those retailers. But at Amazon, customer demand is growing. Besides the warehouse jobs, it's also hiring 2,000 customer service workers. No heavy lifting required. I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
There's news about advertising today. A multi-billion dollar merger of two of the world's biggest names in that curious business, Omnicom and Publicis. They will now be the biggest name in advertising, a $35 billion behemoth with brands like Apple and Samsung and Coke and Pepsi all under the same corporate umbrella. But as Marketplace's Sabri Benishaw reports, the ad game nowadays almost isn't about the products anymore. It's all about the data.
On Mad Men, Don Draper had this to say about the craft of advertising.
Technology is a glittering lure, but there's the rare occasion when the public can be engaged on a level beyond flash if they have a sentimental bond with the product.
True, but today, quaint.
The advertising world is so different from the Mad Men world.
Joe Turo is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School of Communication.
Today, using math to figure out where your audiences are and what they are and how to send specifically personalized messages to them, that's the wave of the future.
And that kind of targeting takes big data, especially for digital advertising, which is small but growing fast. With companies like Google and Facebook collecting information on every digital move we make, they're eating into the business of traditional ad agencies. They work with them, but they also work directly with advertisers. And that's given traditional ad agencies a run for their money, says Turo.
These companies are having to justify their existence in terms of media buying and planning against the powerhouses of the digital age.
By merging, Omnicom and Publicis can negotiate cheaper ad prices. They'll also be able to invest in new marketing technologies on a vast scale that rivals competitors. But as much as the proliferation of data collecting companies may pose a threat, it also presents an opportunity. Clark Fredrickson is a vice president at eMarketer.
Today, marketers face such a complex array of ad technologies and choices, it's becoming a very confusing place to be a marketer.
That's where Omnicom and Publicis see a future together, investing in that technology and making it simpler for advertisers. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
A quick flashback to the financial crisis before we move on, and what may well turn out to be a peek inside one of the biggest and most controversial bailouts of those stressful times back at the end of 2008. AIG, the big insurance company, got government help to the tune of $180 billion, as you might recall. It's right up there with the biggest of the too big to fail crowd. The former CEO of AIG, Hank Greenberg, has sued the government, saying the payback terms of that deal were too harsh. Well, in keeping with that other saying about payback, the judge in the case ruled today that Ben Bernanke, who as Fed chair had the final say on the bailout, can indeed be forced to testify in Greenberg's suit, deposed, technically. So we might, when the trial starts next year, get an up-close and personal look at how the whole thing went down from the guy who made the decision. Speaking of down, that brings us to Wall Street. Red arrows all the way. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Politicians spend a lot of time talking about cutting down on government waste. But it's usually pretty anecdotal, not all that analytical. What do you suppose would happen, though, if you apply the same techniques to government spending that traders use to pick stocks? What's going to pay off and what's just a waste of money? A Pew MacArthur report out today looks at how states are using cost-benefit analysis to make smarter public policy. Sarah McCammon reports now on how that's working out in one state so far.
Last year, Iowa's prison system took an inventory of a bunch of its programs: job training, GED completion, drug treatment. Most turned out to be a good deal for taxpayers in the long run. Participants were less prone to reoffend and more likely to become productive, with one big exception.
We found out that our programs for domestic abusers, which is a tremendous concern in society, they don't work.
Letty Prell is the director of research for the Iowa Department of Corrections. She says programs for men sentenced to probation and a batterer's education course turned out not to do much good. In some cases, participants were more likely to abuse again.
Not only are we not addressing domestic violence in terms of likelihood of future domestic violence, but we're not being responsible stewards of the money that we're given to run this.
For every dollar spent, Iowa was losing $3. More effective programs, like drug courts, were returning close to $10 for every dollar invested. Gary Van Landingham is director of the Pew MacArthur Results First Initiative. As states face tight budgets, he says cost-benefit analysis is becoming more common.
So studies have identified sets of programs which the research is very clear are good investments for taxpayers.
So what do states do when they've made a bad investment? Move the money somewhere else. Iowa corrections officials are developing a new domestic abuser treatment program with help from Erica Lawrence, a psychology professor at the University of Iowa. She says the old approach focused on trying to change negative thoughts. In the new program, offenders are taught to acknowledge those thoughts but behave differently.
And believe it or not, that is working.
Early results in a study of more than 800 men appeared to cut rates for repeat offenders in half compared to just 5% for the old way. If that holds true in the long term, it will save the state plenty in court costs and incarceration, not to mention the impact on victims, something harder to put a price on. I'm Sarah McCammon for Marketplace.
There is an addendum to that story we just ran about data from a Pew study. There are Pew reports on the sandwich generation, modern parenthood, young adults in the recession, key data on U.S. Catholics, how millennial are you? There's like a million of these things. Is there a Pew report on Pew reports? David Weinberg reports on the reports.
Last year, the Pew Research Center put out 450 reports. Those reports were cited in over 60,000 news stories.
I think we fill a gap in the marketplace.
Alan Murray is the president of the Pew Research Center. He says the main reason the media relies on their research is that in a world of liberal and conservative think tanks, Pew Research is a fact tank.
We don't take positions, we don't advocate, and I think there's clearly a need for that.
Murray says that Pew has made a point of doing research that is informed by what is being covered in the media.
In fact, what happens here is a kind of alchemy between journalists and social scientists.
Another key to Pew's success has been the way it distinguishes itself from academic research. Pew has made a point of making its research easy for journalists to use.
And that's a difference from a lot of academics who do a lot of important and interesting research, but often don't know how to get it into the mainstream discussion.
Joshua Benton is the director of the Nieman Journalism Lab at Harvard. He says Pew has become a brand that journalists know they can go to for quality data, and they do nearly every day. I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace.
Say what you will about Edward Snowden, but the fact of the matter is that we now know a bit more about exactly how much privacy we have. Not as much as we thought we had a month and a half ago is the answer. But if you don't like that answer, if you wanted to disappear off the grid, as it were, but not drop out of daily life, could you? And if so, what would you have to do? New York Magazine writer Kevin Roos spent a day trying to live completely surveillance-free. Kevin, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
We should probably define terms here, right? This is not you going camping in the woods and turning off your cell phone for a week, actually. This is staying in society, but hiding, kind of.
I wanted to see if it was possible to go an entire day without surveillance, but not, you know, become Amish or move to the woods by, you know, I wanted to actually communicate with a phone and go online and do my normal work.
So let's start with the very basics. What are the first couple of things you did?
Well, I had to turn off all the devices in my house that send information about me outside. So that meant my iPad, my iPhone, my Kindle, my Xbox, sort of all the gadgets that we don't know what they're saying about us to the companies. And then I had to sort of download a whole suite of privacy apps and pieces of software that allowed me to camouflage my internet traffic and send secure text messages and things like that.
This is an experiment, obviously. Would you call it a success?
I think so. I mean, if the goal was to avoid all kinds of surveillance, I definitely failed. I don't think it's possible to live a modern life and not be surveilled. Even if you surveillance-proof all your gadgets, some satellite somewhere is always going to be able to find you. So in that terms, I think I probably only eliminated maybe 80% of the surveillance on me. But it was remarkably effective at teaching me how pervasive surveillance is. It's not just your phones and your emails. It's security cameras. It's you know, things in taxi cabs that track you. It's, you know, there are a lot of ways that we're being surveilled that we don't even necessarily know unless we stop to look around.
Speaking of those surveillance cameras, tell me about your hat, man. This hat you put together to...
I built a custom anti-surveillance hat. It's a baseball hat, and I cut four holes in it, and I put four infrared LED lights inside the hat right above the brim. And the purpose of this is that most security cameras run on infrared so that they can see you at night. When you turn the hat on, it creates a glow, an infrared glow that you can't see with the naked eye. But on an infrared camera, my head would just show up as sort of a giant glowing ball of light.
And that's the thing most of us don't think about, right? It's the walking down the street thing where the cameras are just everywhere.
Absolutely. And as someone pointed out to me, I probably set off some trigger at the NSA. You know, who's the guy walking around looking like a glowing ball of light?
This was what, last Friday you did this, a couple of days ago?
Yeah, this was a couple of days ago.
Have you heard from the NSA yet?
No, although I think I hear some black helicopters hovering right over my house.
Obviously, this experiment of yours will end, and we should say that today's post was left hanging with you walking out of the house about to start your day. What's the moral of the story?
Every new technological tool that sends or receives data about us that improves our lives comes at a cost. We like Facebook because it lets us keep in touch with our friends. It also catalogs and transmits a tremendous amount of information about us. So with each new thing that we adopt into our lives, we're giving something up, and that's real.
Is this something anybody can do? I mean, you follow this stuff. You're technically savvy, but if I wanted to, can I do this?
You absolutely could. All you need is some software that you can buy online, some tinfoil to wrap your devices in so they're not transmitting. I mean, this is not a surveillance-proof setup. This was sort of an amateurish setup, and I'm sure I could have done much better with CIA tools, but With amateur tools, it's possible to get pretty close.
You realize, of course, if you walk around with your cell phone wrapped in tinfoil, people are going to start staring at you. Forget the NSA, man. It's the guy in the street.
I think they thought it was a burrito or something.
Kevin Roos, he's a writer at New York Magazine. Kevin, thanks a bunch.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up.
In California, there's an overabundance of chihuahuas, which aren't easy to find in other areas of the country.
A story of supply and demand for pets. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. The Dow Industrial's off 0.25% today, 36 points, closed at 15,521. The NASDAQ gave back about 1/3%, 14 points, 35.99. The S&P 500 also tossed off 1/3%, 6 points, ended at 16.85. With the Fed set to meet tomorrow on interest rates, not that they're going to change anything, financial firms somehow seem to be bracing for bad news. B of A, Bank of America, backed up 1.4% today. Morgan Stanley, Goldman Sachs, and Citigroup all reversed more than 1%. Mixed bag for tech stocks, though. Apple took home an extra 1.5%. Google left 1/3% on the floor. Microsoft chipped off about 0.25% today. Investors continue to like Facebook. The social network picked up more than 4%. On this Monday, bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.6% flat. You're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Senate Budget Committee takes up the issue of health care costs. The Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates, and she lied just a little in Romy and Michelle's high school reunion. Actress Lisa Kudrow turns 50. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz has spent the past year talking to people who live on a single street in Shanghai. It's called the Street of Eternal Happiness. He's done 12 stories, one a month, about the world's second biggest economy, told on a really personal level. Today, in episode 13, the last, Rob wraps it up with a look back.
Last year, when I met Master Chu Hongsheng, he had been making qipaos, the form-fitting dress popular in pre-communist China, for 80 years. Master Chu is now 95 years old. And this time, when I pay him a visit at his shop on the Street of Eternal Happiness, he has news for me.
I figured it was time to retire. I still come here to the shop to chat with friends, but I'm just a bystander now.
When he's not at the shop, he whiles away his days at performances of pingtan, folk music from his hometown of Suzhou. It's been a good run for Master Chu. He's gone from serving the family of Shanghai's most notorious gangster in the 1930s to the wives of communist leaders in the 50s to Chinese Hollywood stars today. Now he's recognized throughout the country as the best qipao tailor money can buy. But here on the Street of Eternal Happiness, he's just another worker trying to get what he can from China's incredible economic growth. He was one of more than a dozen people I sat down with over the past year along this street to talk about their hopes, dreams, and their place in 21st century China. A few blocks down the street, I catch up with Zhao Silin, hard at work at her flower shop. In the past year, business has slowed. So has China's economy, steered by the frugal policies of new president Xi Jinping.
The government's cracking down on banquets and other expenditures for local officials. That's been bad for business. Hotels have lost business, too. Fashion stores along the street are closing, and rents are starting to drop.
Zhao's sitting inside her tiny air-conditioned shop surrounded by flowers, writing Chinese characters along red banners for the opening of a Thai restaurant down the street. Her son and daughter-in-law are outside in the 100-degree heat assembling floral displays. Neighbors fanning themselves on lawn chairs keep an eye on Zhao's 18-month-old grandson, who's wandering in and out of shops next door. Zhao came here 20 years ago from a mining town in northern China. When she arrived, she couldn't wait to see the ocean. In Chinese, Shanghai means on the sea. In fact, the sea is an hour away. The city was built along a river.
I wore red socks and a big flower in my hair. I thought people in the city dressed that way. I walked past a bridge and I asked people, is this the sea? They laughed and said no. I had always dreamed of seeing the sea.
So Zhao settled for her favorite song at the time, Big Sea. She listened to it when she missed her husband, a coal miner hundreds of miles away. If only the sea could take away our sorrow, the song goes, like it draws water from a river. Back then, Zhao took a 12-hour train ride once a year to see her family. In today's China, the journey takes 3 hours on a high-speed train. She sees them every other month. Back then, she had to convince her sons to live with her in Shanghai.
Now when we return home, my own grandson won't even eat the food from my hometown. He just wants to eat Shanghai food. I'm thinking of sending him home for good so he knows where he comes from. In the end, we should all return home.
I asked Zhao about the Chinese dream. Xi Jinping has positioned the concept as a guiding principle for his presidency, the idea that all Chinese deserve equal opportunity to enjoy a prosperous life. In his first speech as leader, President Xi said to realize the Chinese dream, the Chinese had to be patriotic and unite to strengthen the nation. I asked Zhao if she's living the Chinese dream.
I don't even know what that means. I don't have time to read about new government policies anymore. I'm busy taking care of my grandson and preparing to hand over my shop to my son and daughter-in-law so that I can retire.
Zhao's not read about the Chinese dream because she's too busy trying to make her own dream come true, being a good mother, a good grandmother, and making preparations to return home. As for Master Chu, he plans to spend his retirement listening to his hometown music and playing poker with his friends. He's lived through a tumultuous hodgepodge of revolution, famine, and war. That's been replaced with an economic system where you can now begin to achieve your dreams, whether they're packaged in political dressing or not. And after I say goodbye to him for the last time, his driver helps him into a black Mercedes that carries him down the street of eternal happiness back home. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We've got Rob's whole series, The Street of Eternal Happiness, on our spiffy new website. Maps, pictures, videos, lots of stuff. Check it out, marketplace.org. You could file this next story under trade imbalances. Or you could file it under the unintended consequences of the law of supply and demand. Or you could file it under homeless puppies. Georgia Public Broadcasting's Adam Ragusea explains.
Meet Kipper, 3 months old, squirmy, little white patch on his head shaped like a heart. And like a lot of dogs in the poor and rural South, nobody wanted him. My wife Lauren and I have been fostering Kipper for a couple of weeks at our house in Macon.
There was an animal cruelty case, and it overflowed the shelter, and the dogs who had been there the longest were going to have to be euthanized.
So a local rescue organization posted the most adorable puppies to Facebook looking for temporary homes. That's how we got involved. But now it's time for Kipper to go. Lots of foster parents like us pull into a parking lot south of Atlanta. We hand our little house guests over to Angie Moore, who loads them onto her customized pet van.
There we go, sweetie.
All right,
okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye.
She'll drive through the night to New England, where there are a lot more people looking to adopt pets. Who pays you?
Rescues, adopters. There's so many people that want to see these dogs get up there.
In Hurricane Katrina, relocation of animals really lit up.
Sandy Montrose is with the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals.
So many groups started moving animals out, and many of those groups are still working to save animals from risk today.
And a lot of the migration remains south to north, but Montrose says other routes are emerging.
In California, there's an overabundance of chihuahuas, which aren't easy to find in other areas of the country.
The ASPCA just launched an online map to help connect exporters with importers, for lack of less callous terms. Speaking of which, meet the person who paid for Kipper's trip north.
My name is Erlene LeBourne. I'm founder of Maine Lab Rescue.
LeBourne got started a year ago and now makes her living from adoption fees. She gets flack sometimes for running a rescue for profit, but...
We have saved over 650 lives at this point.
I asked all these people, why are there so many more unwanted pets in the South than the North? Short answer, poverty. A lot of folks can't afford to care for their pets, and shelters definitely noticed an influx when the economy tanked. LeBourne thinks there's also a cultural issue.
Folks just don't spay and neuter. By the same token, here in Maine, spay and neuter is a way of life.
And weather is a factor. Stray dogs can't hack a real winter, but where it's warm year-round, a dog can live a full life on the street, eating garbage and making more doggies. Kipper, by the way, got adopted by a family in Portland, Maine. They renamed him Damon. Not sure how I feel about that. In Macon, Georgia, I'm Adam Ragusea for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, picking up where our story up top about Amazon warehouse jobs left off. Kinda. I saw this in the Wall Street Journal today, a study by a company called Indeed.com. It's a job search website. They say requirements for social media skills in their job listings are way up, even from last year. Jobs saying Instagram skills were desirable, that's the photo sharing app, up 644%. Twitter abilities up a relatively paltry 44%. But one does wonder, doesn't one, how hard those skills are to acquire? All right, we're done. That's it. That's Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. The Dow Industrial is down 0.25% today, about 36 points, 15,521 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gave back 0.3%, 14 points, 35.99. The S&P 500 also 0.3% down, 6 points, 16.85. Our producers include Bridget Bonder, Mary Dew, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Jolie Myers, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.